Hello and welcome to If I Speak, the birds are singing, spring is springing, and I am joined by what is known in a court of law as my accomplice, Moya Lothian McLean. How are you doing today?
I just want to refute what you said because the spring is not springing. This is one of the worst, grimmest springs that we have had that I can remember. The spring is not here. They did stop the spring from coming. And I also just want to make a quick apology to our dedicated and beloved listeners. Somebody, my assistant, when packing for the work trip I'm on at the moment, forgot to pack their microphone. Sorry, she forgot to pack my microphone. It definitely wasn't my fault at all. So my sound is not as good as it usually is. Apologies.
Who's your assistant?
You don't know her. She goes to a different school, and it definitely wasn't my fault.
We also have, if we are going to be continuing with my criminal justice metaphor, what I think is known as an accessory to the fact. So a little bit later, we are going to be joined by Matt Kendall, co-host of The Love Cupboard, a podcast for men about dating, love, and mental health. And basically, we're bringing him on to see if what I've got to say about straight men is completely delusional, or maybe it is hitting somewhere near the mark. So later on, I'll be sharing my big theory about the best advice you can give to a straight guy. And we've got an audience dilemma about the interpersonal dynamics of the private rental sector. As always, if you think that we couldn't possibly make any of your problems worse, please send them to us and we might try and talk them through. Just email ifispeak@navaramedia.com. That's ifispeak@navaramedia.com. But first, as always, is our traditional icebreaker, 73 questions, minus 70, because who's got time for 73? Moya, what do you got for me?
All right, let's go with the big guns. What was your first thought this morning?
My first thought this morning, it's actually really sad. because I am very much grieving at the moment. My stepdad, who was like, you know, a dad to me, died 2 weeks ago. So every morning I wake up, I open my eyes and I go, oh, fuck. So that was my first thought this morning. My second thought this morning was, I better feed the cat.
I both regret and I'm happy I asked that question because I think it is, this is a podcast about being real. And this is something very real that you're going through. And I really understand and empathize with that level of waking up and remembering someone that you love very much is not in your life anymore. So I'm sure we will probably talk about this in future on the podcast. But now I need to ask you another trivial question. So what was the last purchase you regretted?
Oh, what's the last purchase I regretted? Oh, it's easy. It's one that I made yesterday. I bought a bottle of oyster sauce and it was actually just way too salty. So then when I used it in my cooking, it was just like overpoweringly, you know, just mouth moisture wicking salty. So a bad oyster sauce.
What brand?
It wasn't Leekum. So
yeah, Leekum slaps. Of course it wasn't Leekum.
Yeah, Leekum's great. Stick with Leekum.
Third question. What is a really popular song that you always skip past?
Really popular song that I always skip past. You know what? Dua Lipa just doesn't do it for me.
I was about to say any Dua Lipa, but then I like Dua Lipa and I still think all her songs sound the same. So it doesn't really matter which Dua Lipa.
Just like no Dua Lipa. Like I sort of associate Dua Lipa with like, you know, songs you hear when like getting your nails or your hair done. And I'm just like, meh.
Why don't you like to hear songs when you're getting your nails or your hair done?
No, I do like hearing songs when I'm getting my hair and my nails done. But, like, I like hearing songs that I enjoy, whereas Dua Lipa is just, it's as if she was created in a laboratory to be heard precisely in that context, which isn't the sign of good music.
You've got to feed the gaze, Ash. Dua Lipa is for the gaze. Of course she was created in a laboratory, a very special laboratory, the same laboratory that produced
Kylie.
What,
like, you know, and I'm very glad about this. I don't think that the gays are underfed when it comes to popular music, all
you're right?
They're not underfed.
Right.
They're not starving.
You're actually so right. My song, for what it's worth, is Hot Stuff by, I want to say something chocolate. What's the name of the band using hot stuff?
Hot Stuff is Donna Summer.
Is it?
Yeah.
Who's the band that's like called Hot Chocolate that sing?
They did You Sexy Thing.
I also hate that song. Those are two songs I don't like. Those are two songs I don't like. I don't like Hot Stuff and I don't like You Sexy Thing.
You know what song I actually really, really love?
Yeah.
Unironically, and it just makes me so happy whenever I hear it. Yeah. It's Kung Fu Fighting.
I'm not going to say anything about that song. I feel like I don't want to get into any trouble, any more trouble. If I speak. Shall you tell us your big theory? Because it is a big theory and it's quite a wild one. So I'm ready. I really want to get into it.
It is a big theory.
I'm ready to bring on our first straight man advisor. We have every time we talk about straight men, we should really bring on an advisor for every demographic we talk about. But every time we talk about straight men, then we get told, what the fuck are you talking about? You don't know anything. So now we've decided to test that theory in real time. So Ash, please introduce your big theory.
Well, first I want to introduce our straight man consultant, Matt Kendall. Matt, it's so good to have you with us today. Are you prepared for a whirlwind tour of mine and Moya's neuroses?
I am absolutely ready, yes.
As ready as anyone can ever be.
Yeah, as ready as I could ever be. Also, thank you for saying that I'm the straight man consultant. I hadn't thought of myself that way, but it's nice. It's nice to have that moniker attached to me.
Nice? What do you mean nice? You're Atlas. You're carrying the weight of the world.
Are you ready to be a mouthpiece for 3.5 billion people?
I'm not sure I am, but I can certainly say some things about being a straight man.
Great. You know what? That's all we need from you. We are more than happy to draw wild generalizations from this one guy we got to agree to come on our podcast.
I mean, we do it when there's no guys present anyway, so we may as well just carry on the tradition. Ash, come on, tell us your big theory. Come on.
All right, big theory. My big theory is that the best advice you can give pretty much any heterosexual man is to remember that women are people. And this first came up ages ago because I was talking to my husband and he was saying that in his 20s, the biggest turning point, transformation for him came when he just sort of realized that women are people. And his approach to dating, his approach to sex, his self-image, how he felt about masculinity, all of these things were changed by this realization that women are people. And so what does it mean to realize that women are people? Because obviously, you know, it's not just a case of like, oh, like they are the same species. It's realizing that how you form a rapport with a woman that you're sexually interested in or potentially sexually interested in isn't actually radically different from how you form a rapport with your female friends. It's also about realizing that women aren't out to get you. They're not looking for weaknesses, and you don't have to do this mad dance of enticement like they're easily spooked deer. You also don't have to, you know, perform this very like rigid, narrow and contradictory version of masculinity to get women to like you either. And also, lastly, but I think also most significantly, if you realise that women are just people, then their judgments don't matter so much and rejection isn't going to kill you. So someone's not interested. That's not a fundamental indictment of who you are. And so the reason why I was thinking about this thing that my husband said, that when his, you know, when he was in his 20s, he realized that women are people and everything changed. I was thinking about it this weekend because I was hanging out with a really close friend of mine who's a single straight man. And he was talking about how he feels this immobilizing anxiety, you know, this like truly paralyzing level of self-consciousness when he's around women who are around his age and also potentially single. So his brain gets really, really busy. He starts catastrophizing. And it really is like he lives or dies by whether these women find him attractive or not. And that's even before he thinks, do I find this person attractive? He really, really needs these women to find him attractive. And obviously, because I'm his friend, I can see that there's a difference between how he feels when he's around women who he thinks of as a potential sexual intrigue and what he's like when he's around women who he's friends with. Because around me, he's very authentic, he's very, very candid, and he's really self-aware without being totally hamstrung by self-consciousness. And so as I was listening to him talk about this anxiety, I was just like, you know that women are just people. Like, the potentially single women that you're meeting on a night out, they're all cut from the same cloth as your female friends with whom you've got very healthy, kind and reciprocal relationships with. And I wasn't saying that in a sort of like, haha, you're a fucking idiot way. But it was kind of new to him, this idea that the women he's interested in are the same species as women that he's friends with. So I really do think that the best advice you can give straight men is to remember that women are people. And I do think it cuts the other way as well. Like, particularly whenever I see straight women talking about men on TikTok, I just think it sounds completely fucking delusional because it's this whole idea that as a straight woman, what you've got to do is like extract maximum value from men in a way that's really dehumanizing and also assumes that men are governed by a set of incentives and behaviors which are just completely alien to me as someone who is friends with straight men. So that saw this TikTok of a girl who's like eating in a restaurant and she was saying how, you know, you should dress up nice and go to fancy restaurants by yourself and a random man will buy you dinner. And I was like, this is completely loopy. Like, it's so far out of the realm of normal male behavior, because if you were to speak to any one of your straight male friends and you're like, would you just buy dinner for a random woman who you saw sitting by herself? They'd be like, no, that's crazy. So yeah, I wonder if this advice that remember women are just people is actually useful for straight men, or if I'm completely just extrapolating something from one thing that my husband said. And I also wonder if this idea of remember that the opposite gender, they're just people, is particularly pertinent for straight people, because the way in which we're socialized into our own gender, it involves being socialized to view the opposite gender as though they're a different species and you've got to perform your own gender in this, like, you know, completely bizarre, dehumanizing way in order to attract them. So yeah, Matt, Moya, what do you reckon? Are women just people?
Well, first of all, thanks very much for having me on. Really, really glad to be here. I mean, look, it sounds obvious to say it because of course women are just people. We're all just people. How can we not be? But I know what you mean by it, and I can understand, I think, that sense of anxiety and maybe even fear and self-consciousness that your friend has expressed. And I think there's always been that element in dating or even just social interactions of making a good first impression, dressing well, looking the part, trying to come across as an interesting and engaging person. For some, that potentially leads to an inclination or a self-imposed pressure to impress, which means potentially deviating from expressing your personality and who you are and that idea of just being yourself, right? But I think it's kind of challenging because I think we have a whole set of vocabulary and messaging around being a certain man that women will be attracted to. That whole idea of nice guys finish last, or nice guys being friend zoned because your behavior isn't conforming to certain stereotypes about what a real dominant or successful man should behave. As well as messaging around what women want. You know, there's lots of advice out on social media. This is what women want from a man. And I guess that means that some young men are still kind of being fed that advice that essentially says to impress a woman, you need to double down on reasserting your masculinity in that traditional way. And I think there's just that ends up with a lot of strategy and game playing that takes us further away from that theory of yours of women just being people, just approaching each other as people we might be attracted to. We might want to get to know and figure out whether we're both a good fit. So I think we have this language and advice that is grounded in kind of conquest and competitiveness. And that means that maybe that search for the partner might not be the relaxed affair it should be, because you're too preoccupied with kind of looks or the idea of being a certain individual. And I think it's also pitched differently with friendships, where you can be more relaxed about who you are. The stakes are lower. It's not that you're trying to impress someone else. And so there's more scope to just be yourself, I suppose. And I think that does make it challenging sometimes for men to differentiate, or also, I guess, to not differentiate between friendships with women and, you know, attraction to women and finding a partner. It's essentially the same thing. I would also say, I hate to bring it up, but I do think dating app dynamics have a part to play in this. I've actually just come off them about a week or so, or a couple of weeks ago, I think. But it really plays into this sense of competitiveness, because basically women end up getting a lot of likes, a lot of matches, perhaps too many in certain cases. And there's probably a small cadre of men who, you know, are attractive enough, who come off polished enough on their dating profile to kind of get matches and get dates. And then other men who perhaps struggle just because of the sheer numbers game that it is, this sort of competitive online marketplace that dating apps are sort of force all of us to play a part in. And so I think that also contributes to this sense of commodification, of emphasis on looks, on being able to sell yourself in a certain way, that again, just, it makes you want to, perhaps makes you want to put across a certain version of yourself that isn't authentic.
I guess I'm interested in what you make of the distinction that straight men draw between women and their friends who also happen to be women. Because it's sort of, as I was chatting with my friend, obviously he knows that I'm a woman, but it sort of didn't occur to him that I was the same kind of woman who, you know, he could encounter and think of as like potentially single. And part of the reason for that sort of distinction and why it's so strong is because when we met and became friends, I was already engaged. The first time I met him, my partner was there too. And so I think I just went straight in the category of not single woman, therefore human. Whereas if he'd encountered me in a way where, even if we weren't attracted to each other and nothing romantic happened, you know, we're still on a path to friendship, but if he encountered me and understood me as a single woman or a potentially single woman, I would have gone into like a completely different category, and his behavior would have been different, and his you know, anxiety levels would have been different. You know, it was sort of like, by being known to be off the market, I was safer somehow.
Yeah, I think that plays into what I was saying about, you know, what you need to do to impress the opposite sex. And it's almost like we're being sent this message of having two different versions of ourselves. One that's, you know, the authentic version of ourselves, where we can express ourselves and who we are, and maybe the other version that needs to put on a certain facade, because it's, as I said, the kind of stakes are higher, or they're different stakes, I guess, around trying to impress someone. I just think ultimately there's just a lot of messaging that is, as I say, grounded in traditional kind of stereotypes about gender roles, about masculinity, patriarchal norms around being this dominant, strong, sort of assertive individual. And that's what is attractive. And, you know, to a certain extent, I guess when we go out into the world and go to bars and clubs, we tend to want to put on that version of ourselves that is confident, that has this really tough kind of steely exterior. And I think all of that just plays into this idea of having, as I say, two different versions of ourselves that doesn't encourage some men, at least, to actually just say, well, I'll just be myself. I'll view this as another way to meet people, express who I am, and see if there's a good fit. Because I think the other thing is, there's perhaps a tendency to always want to impress, as opposed to seeing it as a process in which you meet someone and you both evaluate how good a fit you are for each other, as opposed to constantly trying to think about how you can impress the other person. So it's not a mutual process. Again, it sort of ties into that competitiveness angle of I have to impress someone else, so these are the behaviors I have to exhibit.
Moya, what do you make of this? Does this resonate at all with your experiences of giving maybe straight male friends advice and also thinking about it from the perspective of like, okay, but I'm having to like deal with and encounter this divided self when I'm out there trying to meet people and trying to date?
First of all, I reject the premise of the initial theory. Because I don't think this is the best advice you can give straight men. I also don't particularly like that we're just being like, this is the best advice you can give straight men. Because this advice is purely for romantic and sexual purposes. I think there's other advice you can give straight men or men of any sexual orientation that would better serve them at meeting and connecting with people for any type of purpose. And this, the way we frame the question kind of implies that we're still putting in the box of the only relations that can happen between straight men is a romantic or sexual connection with a woman who dates men. So the premise of the question I reject. I'm really sorry, all the theory I reject. But that's fine. We're here to have that disagreement. We're here to have that discourse.
I just want to impress you. That's all
No,
I've
you.
ever wanted.
Oh, see, Ash, maybe this is where it's coming from. You're projecting onto the straight man. No, I'm joking. So what I was thinking when you were both talking, I thought what Matt was saying was really interesting about this idea, this pressure of split self and the lack of synthesis that you at least feel as a straight man when engaging in a romantic or sexual way with people that you're romantically or sexually interested in, and how there's a division as well between the people classed as your friends, who might belong to the same gender category that you would normally be sexually attracted to, and the people who are classed as those romantic interests who you have been like, actually, I am attracted to them, and therefore I myself is split and I have this pressure to impress them. What I think about a lot and what's coming from this and the discussion of like the both sides, the game playing, all of that, is I don't think this is a problem restricted only to heterosexuality. I think that it's something we see quite prevalent in like our generation. I can't speak for older generations, but I know that if you are single and older, then you've probably been sucked into more of the strategizing and game playing, because if you were dating in a modern fashion, then you are going to be doing it within the frameworks that we have now. And I think that it just comes back to what we talk about again and again and again, which is that the nature of dating, modern dating has changed. We don't know exactly, it doesn't have like a single purpose anymore. And I think that's really thrown heterosexual dating in particular into, you know, chaos, because no one knows exactly what it's for. Like it used to be definitely going to do it for marriage, and a lot of people still have that in their minds, but the rituals and parameters that govern those courtship processes are gone. And it's not like you meet someone, you present a ring, and it's like, okay, that's a promise, we're going to get married, and then we're going to exist whether happily or miserable for the next 40 years. And obviously there were deviations from that within that framework, but that was the traditional framework. I think it's silly to imagine that people who aren't straight and people who aren't straight men don't suffer from this idea of splitting the self and needing to impress. And I know you mentioned straight women as well, but I don't want to just like gender essentialize it or sexuality essentialize it either. I don't think that's the right term. I think in a world where scopic capitalism, which is this like the power of the visual currency that we carry based on perceived attractiveness, which is not like how attractive you are to another person, but it's how much you fit into a certain type of attractiveness that might carry traction on platforms like social media, or I don't know, just like in that digital world, then there's going to be more of the split cells. Because I see this constantly on, you know, social media sites, TikTok, platforms like that, where it's this idea of like glow up, glow up, glow up, glow up, glow up. And it's like, who are we glowing up for? What is the purpose here? It is this, okay, it's this idea of attractiveness. What is the attractiveness for? It's this sort of like latent sexual attractiveness that's not actually very sexy or anything to do with sex in reality. It's got much more to do with just like the reception of being attractive. And I think that plays more to like split self and like being attracted to the people. But what you're noticing more and more and more is people complaining they can't actually connect with someone else on like an emotional level. And that actually when they're presented with, you know, conventionally attractive people on, say, a dating app, you all blur into one and it's like there's no actual spark or connection or any of that. And some of that's the platform, but also in real life, you get that quite a lot. It's like this just, it's almost like Ken dolls and like Barbies where you all blur into like one smooth mass of non-genitalia. And it's just like, you're so gorgeous and there's nothing happening because we're just focused on like the peacocking. I don't know if that makes sense, but in my head, there is a stream of consciousness there where I'm trying to basically say, I don't think that this is the best advice we can give to straight men or anyone. I think the best advice we can give to people is actually, because I think this is framed around the idea of romantic and sexual connection. I think the best advice we can give to people is the advice that the actress who played Jessa, Jemima Kirk, gave on social media. Someone said, what advice would you give to young girls who have like anxieties? And she was like, I think you think about yourselves too much. And that is the advice I would give. I think we think about ourselves too much.
You know what? That's really interesting. I will come back to, I think, standing up for my big theory. But I think that advice of, you know, I think you think about yourself too much. One of the things that's really interesting is that a friend of mine who's in recovery and is in recovery for narcotics, alcohol, sex and relationships, the advice that he receives most often from his sponsor is stop thinking about yourself so much. And identifying that sort of compulsive self-consciousness as a thought pattern which reinforces feelings of emptiness, which primes him for compulsive behaviors where he's not in control of himself. And when he's sort of in the thrall of this behavior, whatever it is, whether it's to do with drugs, sex, relationships, or alcohol. And so that being a form of advice which is given to people when they're having to really reassert some kind of control over themselves and like build up their sense of self from, you know, literally rock bottom, I think goes to show just how crucial it really is. And we live in a society, but we live in a society where we've got so many mirrors to the self. We've got so many mirrors to the self where we're constantly engaging with a reflection that we've created and that other people are interacting with. It's really hard not to think about yourself so much because everything we have in society is telling us to do it. The reason why I think that you can redeem the big theory of the best advice you can give straight men is to remember that women are people is that it is a reminder that everyone you're interacting with is a person just the way you are. So if you don't make insane arbitrary judgments of other people, the likelihood is that the person that you're interacting with and interested in isn't going to be doing that either. It's a reminder that, you know, rather than sort of setting up sexual and romantic connection as the sort of be all and end all, it's actually situating that within all the other kinds of social connection that you can have and saying, remember, this is like this, right? You know, it's not a completely different category. And I think that for what did for my husband when he realized this, it meant that he could be a lot more relaxed about, in particular, having sex, because, you know, in his 20s, you know, early 20s, he'd go out and if he didn't hook up with someone, regardless of whether or not he'd met someone who he found attractive, but if he'd gone out and someone hadn't made it clear that they found him attractive enough to go home with, he very much internalized that as like, I am unattractive. There's something wrong with me. I failed in my masculinity somehow. And that reminder that women are people, it's not just about how do you become a more attractive proposition, though I think that, of course, people who are relaxed in themselves, you know, that's a very attractive quality. It was also about changing the way he saw himself. And it opened up possibilities of all kinds of relationships, sexual, romantic, and also friendships as well. I mean, yeah, Matt, what do you sort of make of that thing about mirrors to the self? Because we often talk about that in relation to women and body image issues and the pressures on performing a certain kind of femininity. But like, how does that context of social media and always being bombarded with, you know, the sort of doppelganger that you've created for yourself online, does that play out in specific ways for straight men? Speak for your people.
I will speak for my people. I think it does put pressure on men as well, increasingly. I think there's just, with social media, there's just a bombardment of advice. Often a lot of it is misguided and unhelpful. But even if you look at the, I don't know, beauty and cosmetics, for instance, I mean, that's a kind of growing industry now for men. Telling them basically to be more concerned about their appearance, that's the kind of key to unlocking success with romantic relationships. Or I don't know if you've heard of the phrase looks maxing.
What's looks maxing?
Basically, this idea that you have to try and improve your appearance to maximize your appearance in any way possible. So that might be exercises to accentuate your jawline, or even just going to the gym, or in more extreme circumstances, going under the knife and actually having some sort of procedure to make yourself look more physically attractive. But it's sort of taken to extremes. And I'm going to fence it a bit on your theory and say, I think it's not a bad piece of advice, but actually I think the key is more, how can we get to a place where authenticity is sort of valued by men and women? And how can we get to a place where authenticity is sort of the goal for both of us, so that we can do away with all this game playing, this strategizing, and ultimately get to what I think we all really want, which is, you know, healthy and thriving relationships where we have all authenticity, honesty, respect, healthy communication, you know, trust, forgiveness. I think all of this kind of gets us further and further away from that. And I think we need to move forward with that by doing away with a lot of the kind of stereotypes around masculinity and gender roles. And maybe there is a bit of that mirror image of saying, you know, don't worry about this so much, but also, you know, how can we get to a place where also men are encouraged to work on their own sort of personal development as well, so that they can have emotional intelligence and maturity and things like that?
Moya, how would you answer that question of how do we get to a place where authenticity is valued?
It's really difficult because there's two pillars for me for what it means to be authentic, and what is authentic will change constantly throughout your life. Like, I think perhaps being authentic is living in a place where you are, for the most part, comfortable and confident in yourself as a person, and you can go into a space and feel happy with the way you proceeded in that space when you leave it without, and this might be controversial, without the influence of additional substances. And that's not saying you can't drink, you can't do drugs if you don't want to, if you do want to, but you don't need those things. You don't need any extra aids to go somewhere, feel confident in yourself and how you proceeded. And when you make mistakes and when you do things you regret, you know how to handle them in a way that doesn't make you feel, leave you with a long lasting feeling of shame and, I don't know, anxiety, but instead can either resolve them in a way that you're happy with, and that you have like a wide circle of, or even a small circle of support. Basically, I think an authentic person is somebody who can live not without regret, but knows how to not let those regrets dominate their life, and they live according to their principles rather than constant external validation. That's just like my vague definition on the fly of what authentic is. But what I'm kind of interested in, and this might be a complete side note, is I want to ask Matt how many female friends he has. Because I'm really interested in this thing in the first place. It's like, if we want to go back to this initial premise and essentialization of straight men, straight women, or just women in general, like how many, you said you had a breakup recently. How many women friends did you have during the relationship? How many women friends do you have now? Because I've noticed with the very scant, completely straight men I have as friends, There's one or two bisexuals in there, but again, quite scant. Like, most of the men I'm friends with are gay men. They tend to disappear during their relationships and then come back. And I don't hold that against them, but I am aware it's because I think with, from what I've heard, the friendships that often straight men have with other men, they don't tend to have like an emotional depositing ground. What's your emotional, where do you talk about emotions? Like, who are the people you go to
on podcasts,
talk about emotions? Apart from on podcasts.
Yes, solely on podcasts. I just go to as many podcasts as I can. I think it's, yeah, probably mostly the female friends in my life that I talk to about emotional issues. Some men as well, but I think a lot of male friendships tend to be somewhat skewed towards doing activities, going to the cinema, going to a gig, where there's less scope, I guess, to kind of get really deep in the weeds. And therapy, essentially. I think without kind of therapy, I think it would be quite difficult for me to express emotional needs or kind of personal issues. And I think that's something borne out in statistics as well. I mean, if you look at statistics around mental health and, even suicide rates for men under 40, like they're really, really high. And it's basically kind of underscores just how difficult it is for men to not only identify that they're having trouble, but actually seeking out help when they are in trouble.
There's also a reciprocity to it. I mean, just as you were saying that, a notification flashed up on my phone, a voice note from one of my straight male best friends. And I know that the content of that voice note is going to be all about emotional connection. And I don't know if this is unusual, but it's a very distinct feature of my life that, you know, in terms of the very close friends I have where we lean on each other emotionally, and actually the main activity you do together is talking about what's going on in your life, that's about 50% straight men. Some are single, some aren't, some are people who I've known since school, some are people who I've met more recently. And I think that there is a cultural change that's going on about what a normal level of explicit emotional interaction is for men. I think that baseline is beginning to change, and that's for the better. And I think that that's where some of this stuff about, you know, do you perceive the opposite sex as this sort of totally alien, you know, other, or do you see them as human beings, much in the same way as you are? That's the place where it can begin to break down. It's through how friendships change your perception. And then I think you can take that out, and that can inform how you make romantic and sexual connections. I'm afraid we're going to have to break up with you now, Matt, and chuck you back into the dog-eat-dog world of dating and romantic connection. But where can the people find you if they want to hear more of what you've got to say?
So they can find us, both myself and my co-host, Dan Reist, on the Love Cupboard podcast, which is on all good podcast platforms. You can also find us on Twitter and Instagram at The Love Cupboard.
Well, we will leave you to The Love Cupboard. Matt, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for having me.
Right, problem solving time. Dear If I Speak, I was living in a house owned by my best friend's mum. We lived there together during our postgrad. They moved out, but I stuck around and a few other friends moved in. Then my friend's parents decided they don't want to keep the house anymore and evicted me and my housemates. The terms of the eviction were fairly reasonable, 3 months notice, last month rent free, but an eviction is an eviction, and leaving a home when you don't want to still sucks. I lived in that house for 3.5 years and it really felt like home. A week or so after I told my friends I'd been evicted, another one of my best friends, who'd been in the house with me for a year, approached my landlord about buying the house. It's going ahead as it was a convenient sale for both of them, and my friend already knows they like living there. It's been really painful for me. The thought of going back to that house as a guest or showing up to a housewarming party makes me feel a bit ill. My homeowner friend said I can move back in as their lodger in a year or so, but I've already moved all my stuff into my new house, and I'm not sure how I feel about having a friend as a live-in landlord in a house that was once my home. I always knew I would start to see friends with generational wealth become homeowners at this age. It was always going to sting, but I didn't think it would ever get this close to home. Pun intended. Pun received. Having one friend's parents evict me, then another completely separate friend buy the house has been a weird sort of double whammy. I felt a lot of pressure to hide my negative feelings from both friends, especially the buying friend. How upset am I allowed to be? So to sum up the dilemma, I lived in a house with a couple of other people, owned by another friend's parents. Parents evicted them, and then a friend who lived in the house bought the house, and now this letter writer is feeling really bad about it. Ash, how upset are they allowed to be?
Well, I think this is an interesting one because there's sort of two dimensions to it, right? One is, how are you supposed to feel and create a sense of home when the economic context that you live in means that that process is really precarious, particularly if you're a renter? Because there are five cities in the UK where the average rent increase is going up more than the rate of inflation. So I think that's Glasgow, Manchester, Birmingham, Bristol, and London. It's of course where a lot of young people live. And your rights are just really in the toilet. There is very little enforcement of what few rights that renters do have are, and you know, landlords want to sell up for whatever reason. They want to cash in on their investment. They're basically risk-free investment because someone else has been paying off the mortgage costs for them, and then they get to just eat up all that lovely, lovely inflated asset value. And so if you're the renter in that context, how do you feel that your home is secure, which is such a basic psychological need? How do you feel that the place where you live is really yours and you're not going to have to move and find another place to live in 6 months, 12 months? I mean, that is just an inherently destabilizing thing. So, you know, no wonder our dilemma sender is feeling upset, because on top of that, they've got this sort of social stratification that's playing out within their social group. So they're left in this really financially precarious situation. That precarity has involved finding a new home. And yet they're seeing that their friends, because of intergenerational wealth, are having a very, very different kind of experience. So in terms of how upset are you allowed to be, the answer is, well, you're going to be quite upset. It's not a question of permission. You just are, because, you know, I think that if you were to model these conditions on like rhesus monkeys in a lab somewhere, those would be some really fucking stressed out rhesus monkeys. So, you know, of course, the same's going to be the case for you. For me, the interesting bit, and this is what I'm really keen to hear your thoughts on, Moya, is this idea of how much of that can you share with your friends who are in a financially different position and in a way have at, you know, a sort of societal level benefited from the sort of economic precarity that you're experiencing. How do you express that to your friends? How do you be real about your feelings without capturing your friends in a dynamic of guilt and shame? That's the thing I can't wait to hear you hold forth on.
Why did you leave the hardest bit for me? Why do I have to hold thoughts on that? I will. But why? Yeah, just to reiterate what you said, it's not a case of how allowed are you to, like, to be upset. How upset are you allowed to be? You will be upset, whatever happens. Just want to underline what Ash said there. You are going to be upset. There are several things here. We talked about this a bit in, I think, a previous episode, about the economic schism that will divide your friend groups. And I was actually discussing this really recently. I discuss it a lot because every time I think about the next time I get evicted and how rubbish that will be when it definitely comes, I think, where am I going to move to? It'll be either the outskirts of London or I'll just have to go. I'll just have to leave. Like, I don't have the money for that. And we were talking about this new concept that's emerging, which is friendlanthropy, I'm calling it. because it particularly emerges in the housing sector, because as we've pointed out, there is a lot of millennials who are actually going to become very wealthy soon or have the assets, because the boomers are dying off and they are going to inherit those assets. It's going to be completely inequitable the way that that inheritance works. This is not a meritocracy. This is not a situation where the economic goods are going to be redistributed equally. Some of us are going to be really rich and have assets suddenly, and some of us are going to stay in the exact same place, and it's going to suck. That's what's happened to you. So this philanthropy thing that I'm seeing with housing is a lot of people our age hold like superficial, at least, left-wing positions. Some of us are quite committed. So when they inherit this wealth, there is this idea of what am I going to do with it? Obviously, I'm going to buy a house. Like, I'm going to, and there's no, because we live in a very, very restricted system. And it's like you either rent or you buy. And unless you have loads and loads of money to suddenly buy up a whole street of houses and turning to some sort of co-op, then what I'm seeing, the way people put that invest their money is they will buy a house and they will let a friend live there. And this is what I mean by philanthropy. You, and I'm seeing it in this letter, which is, for example, someone buys a house and they say, you can live here, the rent free, you can live here for a reduced amount of money. But it is totally reliant on interpersonal dynamic, and it is not secure in any way. And it causes resentment and still worry, because at any point you could fall out with your friend. It is, I think, even worse than philanthropy, because it's not just this idea of like faceless charitable donating. It is charitable donating that puts your interpersonal relationship and your dynamic at the center. And you, whatever happens, have to get on with your housemate from then on. You are living under their roof. You are having to tread in a way that means that if you fall out with them, you might become homeless. And people say, no, that will never happen. That will never happen. It happens all the fucking time. People are unpredictable. You never know how your feelings will change. We are a species that is often prone to impulsive, irrational, egotistical decisions. And I do see it a lot that there's a living situation and someone has more power in the dynamic and it changes, and then someone is homeless. That happens all the time in breakups, in friendships. So in the letter writer says, you know, they said I could be their live-in lodger. I don't think it's just the fact you've moved all your stuff to another home that is causing you stress about that. It's the idea of being totally at the will of your friend in that house. You might be paying money, but you're still, you know, there's a power dynamic that stops you being on an equal level. And that is really distressing as well. But I also want to flip this, because the friend that has bought the house also lived in that house. They also have viewed that house as their home. So this is another thing with house shares. When you have multiple people living in that house, who has the claim to that house? It's not fair that they have the money to buy the house. It's not, you know, there was a raffle and someone just got a name and that's fine. It's all democratic or whatever. They had the wealth to buy it, but they view it as much as their house as you have viewed it, your house. That's the problem. So I imagine that as well is very difficult when you're trying to discuss this with your friends, and when you're trying to say, you know, this is making me feel away, because they can just be like, well, I live there too. This is my house if you bought it up. And there is also this level of like pseudo politeness that surrounds discussions of finance and money. When someone has more money, it's almost vulgar to reference that you're really stinky rich and you just bought a fucking house. You'll talk about behind their back. You'll be like, this bitch just bought a house. Like, damn, she's fine. She's living. But to their face, you just got to be like, well done. That's amazing. Congratulations. Because it's kind of considered rude to point out these discrepancies. And especially if it's money that's unearned, you just kind of be like, well, that's really relieving for you. That's really relieving for you. You know, from the friends who have bought houses around me, it's weird. I don't actually envy them that much, because it's just so far away from my realms of possibility that I have to work to find the empathy when they complain about stuff, which is like, you know, actually costs way more to do this. And I'm like, yeah, but bitch, you now got a house. you've now got a secure asset.
You have an asset.
The question of how do you discuss with your mates? How do you stop this from pulling yourselves apart? And I don't know if there's like a really one size fits all answer here. The first thing is you're upset. The second thing is, you want to tell them you're upset. You want them to know that you're sad about this, and you don't feel like there's an outlet to do this. And that is sort of that is like the real sticking point here, that you can't express. And this is the probably one of the first points of major difference within your friend group, by the sound of it, that two people have these houses, or like their parents have the house, and then one of them's bought the house, and then everyone has to be happy about it. And this is the first time where the people that you would normally go to talk about something that upsets you, they are the source of the issue. I would just genuinely be honest and say, look, I really understand that this is not your fault, that you've bought this house and that you also, it's also your home. I just want to say to you, I'm struggling a bit because it makes me sad that I will never, not never, it makes me sad that I can't envisage at this moment being in the same position, and I don't have somewhere secure to live. And I know you've offered to let me be your lodger, and I would love to think about that some more, but I'm not in an immediate position to say yes because of X, Y, Z and all these reasons. And I'm telling you this not because I want you to feel guilty or ashamed that you've been able to do this, but because I want to be honest with you and clear the air. And I'll add one more thing, which is that my friends who are in programs like AA, they have this thing called a resentments list that they do in, I think, step 4. And I've recently thought I need to do this because you write out your resentments, and some of them you do like analysis. Sorry for anyone in AA who thinks I'm actually butchering this, by the way. But the basic premise is you write out your resentments and you kind of analyze particularly what about those things you resent. And it always comes back to something to do with you. And this is obviously a social problem that you've been stuck in the middle of. And I don't think it's up to you to have to, you know, suddenly be all happy for your friends and put all this aside. But getting that stuff out and saying it out loud, like you've done here, like you've typed to us, but also finding a way to express it to people really does help disassociate that resentment. And that will make your friendship stronger in the long run. Because unfortunately, there is nothing you can do on a material level at this point that will fix the problem, like being able to buy your own house. All you can do is control how you communicate this resentment and how you, I don't know, process it with your friends. Because that's kind of the only way forward, unless you want to do a massive life blow up and just like exit from them, which I don't advise on any level.
See, this is why I asked you for the difficult bit of advice, because you're really good. I think, however, that is all we have time for this week. Moya, you've been great. You're always great.
What if I was shit? Would you tell me if I was shit, Ash?
Not while we were recording.
Once I said to a therapist, I was like, can you give me some feedback that isn't good? And she was like, I think, and her feedback was, you always want people to criticize you. Read to shit. Well,
anyway. You walked straight into that one.
Yeah, and that was the only piece of useful constructive criticism she actually gave me. She didn't criticize me enough. Anyway, Ash, you also have been great. So this is just now a circle jerk.
Oh my God, I love you so much. Oh my God. And we also love you so much. And we'll be back next week. This has been If I Speak. Thank you so much for tuning in.
Bye.